So good afternoon. It's great to see so many members and guests here today. And I'd like also to welcome those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. The Mid-Coast Forum was founded in 1983. This is our 456th meeting with a foreign affairs expert invited to speak and answer questions on issues critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. Please visit our website, midcoastforum.org, for audios of past forum talks and information about upcoming forum speakers. Audios of our speakers are now also available on the Maine Monitor website, mainemonitor.org. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a member of the forum and attending our talks. You will find our membership form on the forum's website. We're pleased to have Ms. Amna Nawaz as our speaker today. I think a lot of you will remember that we had Suja Nawaz as a speaker in March of 2020. That was the last speaker we had before we shut down during the pandemic. And I think this may be our first time when we've had a father-daughter team come and speak. We've had some husbands and wives, and I think we will in the future have some more husbands and wives, or wives and then husbands, come to speak. But it's the first time, I think, with a father and then daughter. The topic of her talk today is on the front line, reporting overseas and here at home. Amna Nawaz currently serves as the co-anchor of the PBS NewsHour. At the NewsHour, she has reported from the White House, across the country, and around the world on a wide range of topics. She also serves as an NBC News and MSNBC political contributor. Prior to joining PBS NewsHour in April of 2018, Ms. Nawaz was an anchor and correspondent at ABC News. Before that, she served as foreign correspondent and Islamabad bureau chief at NBC News. She is also the founder and former managing editor of NBC's Asia America program. All throughout her career, Ms. Nawaz has covered major events. She covered the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, spending several hours reporting from outside the Capitol building during the attack as part of the NewsHour team honored with a Peabody Award for its coverage. She also covered the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, the elections and inaugurations of Presidents Biden, Trump, and Obama, Hurricane Katrina, the 2010 Haiti earthquake, the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and the September 11th terrorist attacks. Truly an impressive list. She has interviewed multiple heads of state, international leaders, and other newsmakers. Ms. Nawaz previously won a Peabody Award for her documentary work on the 2019's The Plastic Problem, which examined global plastic pollution and efforts to address it. She has done a number of other documentaries and has hosted three seasons of the primetime PBS series Beyond the Canvas, featuring profiles and interviews of some of the world's leading artists, musicians, and creators. In 2019, Ms. Nawaz became the first Asian American and the first Muslim American to moderate a presidential debate. While at ABC News, she hosted documentaries and a podcast series. And at NBC News, she was the first foreign journalist to gain access to North Waziristan, then the global hub of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and all this while she was pregnant with her first daughter. Ms. Nawaz was a fall 2021 fellow at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Asian American Journalists Association, the South Asian Journalists Association, and the Inter-American Dialogue. In 2022, she was a recipient of the Vision Award from the Asia Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies and the Media Award from the Muslim Affairs Public Council. She received the American Muslim Institution's Excellence in Media Award in 2018 and an Emmy as part of the 2009 NBC News special Inside the Obama White House. Ms. Nawaz earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania and a master's degree at the London School of Economics. Quite an impressive resume. Amna, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
George, thank you so much. George, thank you so much for that wonderful and warm introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you here today. As George mentioned, I was the first Western journalist granted access to North Waziristan in 2013. My husband, Paul, and I like to joke, since I was pregnant at the time, our daughter, Karam, is actually the second. And I think she should get credit for that. I'm really pleased to be here with you today, and thank you so much for rearranging your schedules to join me on this weekend. A special thank you to our dear friends Eric and Diane, who didn't have to twist my arm very much to convince us to come here. I'm going to be playing a few clips from some of my work over the years, and I've planned for about 30 or 35 minutes to share with you my perspective on my work, and then I would love to open it up for questions, because I have found the more I get out to be able to speak with people who I know are so deeply engaged in some of these issues, the more I learn as well from your questions. So I do hope to reserve a good amount of time for those as well. Now, the topic of my remarks today is on the front lines, reporting overseas and here at home. And I arrived at that title for a couple of reasons. One, because I have always believed that the job of journalists is to go to the front lines, to go to the story, whether that is down the street from your home or in the halls of power or thousands of miles away on the other side of the world. Journalism for me was always and is still about bearing witness. It's about showing up. I see it as closing the gap between the reality that's unfolding on the ground and what people on the other side of the world need to know and understand about that reality. I think back often to one of my very first bosses in this business, who was also one of my all-time favorite bosses in this business. He was a man named Leroy Sievers. And he was 6'4", but he really appeared to be 8'4", because he was just a giant guy with big shoulders and a booming voice, and he had covered every major global news story in the 80s and 90s before moving into management and becoming the executive producer at Nightline, where I joined as a fellow in 2001. That was my very first job in journalism, and Ted Koppel was the anchor at the time. And Leroy said something that stuck with me very early on. He said, journalism is a lot like life. 80% of it is just showing up. You have to be there. You have to see what other people cannot see. You have to hear and feel and immerse yourself in what they cannot. This isn't the kind of job that you can do at a safe distance, he would say. You have to be willing to show up. And this giant of a man used to impart these words of wisdom on me and the other Nightline kids, as we were known back then. And we would all listen wide-eyed and amazed and just think about all the possibilities that this job, you know, could we believe this was actually a job? All the possibilities this job held for us. And what he said resonated with me as someone who craved adventure but was also deeply curious about the world around me. And it stayed with me throughout my career. If something was happening, I wanted to be there in the middle of it. I still feel that to this day. The other reason I arrived at this title for my remarks, though, and this relates to the part about reporting overseas and here at home, is because I've come to see several links between the work that I was doing and the stories that I was covering overseas for many years, and the stories that I've now had to cover more recently here at home. And these are links, I will tell you, that I never anticipated would exist or that I would see here in this country I call home all these years later. But these are links that speak, I think, to where we are as a nation, the direction that we're headed, the challenges that we're facing here as a country and as it relates to our place in the world. Now, I share all of this with you because I think how we arrive at this work as journalists helps to inform how we do the work as journalists. And part of what I hope to do today is just pull back the curtain a little bit about how my reporting comes together and how this work is done. And so while many of you know, as I've moved into this anchor role, my primary job at the PBS NewsHour, I'm still a reporter at heart. And I think I will always be a reporter at heart. And no reporter, unless it's your very first day on the job, begins at zero with any story. So it's no exaggeration to say that covering some of the biggest foreign stories of our time has absolutely informed how I've covered some of the biggest domestic stories as well. And that connection between what we classify as foreign reporting in this business and what we classify largely as domestic political reporting, it's not something I think most journalists have necessarily. This is not a typical path for most journalists. And it's not a connection that we make in our work, frankly. And we see those through lines now. I see them as to be intensely familiar with, you have to be intensely familiar with both the details on the ground overseas and here at home. And what I've found is that those connections absolutely exist. They have become stronger in recent years, and they've really struck me as a journalist and as an American. And I'll go into more detail a little bit more on that later. Now, I began my career as a producer, and as many network television producers do, I was just racking up frequent flyer miles, flying into breaking news stories across the country and the world. I was in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. I spent a lot of time along the Gulf Coast after the BP oil spill. I covered the election inauguration of multiple presidents. I will say building a career is more, a lot more than just covering all the high-profile, exciting stories. So I feel it's important to point out that I also spent several days straight camped outside of Alderson Federal Prison, which is a minimum security prison in Greenbrier, West Virginia, where I, along with hundreds of other journalists, was waiting for Martha Stewart to report to prison to begin serving her sentence after she was convicted of multiple financial crimes so that we could be the first to report it on MSNBC and NBC News that day. See, that story is not mentioned as much in my resume or introductions, but I think it was just as important. And I have to say, I always say, every story is a chance to grow. Now, in particular, because most of my career, most of my early career was in those formative post-9/11 years, I covered a lot of national security and intelligence stories, foreign policy stories, stories about terrorism and alleged terrorists. And it was, as many of you I'm sure will remember, it was a time of great uncertainty and chaos and really fear as a nation. I mean, we were constantly in a state of high alert. Where would the next attack come from? When would it come? Who else was out there who wanted to hurt us? You'll remember we launched wars quickly. And we in the media, I think we all have come to this agreement now, we in the media did not do what we should have to sufficiently question many of the reasons and the justifications behind those wars and how they were carried out. And we have now had enough time go by and enough distance to be able to look back and see with clarity the questions that we did not ask and the assumptions that we failed to examine. We, and I as a young journalist, we accepted the official narrative of this war on terror as it was framed. We used that framing for our own reporting and we internalized it. It became a kind of foundational common sense notion. I remember at NBC News at the time, actually, the coverage of America's wars abroad all fell under the title of America Strikes Back. And it was in part what led me to want to do more work overseas. I knew how we covered the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq from the US. I knew how we talked about events on the ground. And yet, as someone who had spent a lot of time traveling the world as a child and a young adult, I had seen a lot of these parts of the world through a very different lens, not as a place where America was striking back, but as something much more. So in 2005, I was actually a young associate producer working at Dateline, and because of my experience overseas, my bosses assigned me to work on a new documentary project. And it was going to be a comprehensive, detailed look at what we called then the global war on terror. It was also going to be Tom Brokaw's first big primetime hour special after he stepped away from the anchor desk at NBC Nightly News, so no pressure on me. And it was actually called The Long War, America's War on Terror. That was the title. If you're interested, you can actually still get the DVD on Amazon for about $6. But that project took me, as a, you know, young 20-something producer, still cutting my teeth in the field, it took me across the planet. We went to Pakistan and Afghanistan, to Saudi Arabia, to England, to France. I embedded with American soldiers. We interviewed intelligence and government officials and diplomats and experts, and I saw how the best in the business did their work and brought those stories home for our audience. And I thought, well, I want to do that. I want to do more of that. And so in 2011, I did. After years of bouncing in and out of the region, covering breaking news in South Asia and the Middle East, I took over NBC's bureau in Pakistan. And I began reporting most of the year from the region, really bouncing between Kabul and Islamabad quite a bit. And what I did, how I saw my role at the time, was I have to be here to stand in the breach, to fill in the gaps of information between what most Americans knew about the ways in which they were being kept safe and the impact of those policy and military decisions on the ground where they landed, quite literally where they landed, because you have to remember, this was at a point in time when the US was launching more drone strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan than anywhere else in the world. And this was a program that had very little transparency. Very few US officials would go on the record about any of this, but it was constantly being held up as one of the many ways in which American leaders were keeping us safe. And in many cases, that was true, because I was there on the ground. I knew that wasn't the whole truth. So I set out to build some sources on the ground in places I knew these drone strikes landed. I found credible sources who were also in search of facts and accountability, and I was able to do something that few Western journalists at the time could, which was offer a window into what was actually happening on the ground. If you give me a moment here, I'm just going to cue up a short clip to give you an example.
But here's the thing about this policy. Nobody ever gets to see that it's happening. And not just in the normal way that we as civilians don't get to see the war fighting that U.S. troops do in other countries. No, in Pakistan, it's something even more than that. There aren't embedded reporters riding along somehow with the drone pilots. The tribal areas where this is happening are explicitly off limits to Westerners, including Western reporters. I know from experience how hard it is to get a visa to cover Pakistan at all as a Western reporter, but to go to report on the impact of the drone strikes in the places where the drone strikes are, the answer is no. And that's why this exclusive report that we've got tonight, which has never been seen anywhere before, is so critically important and so fascinating. This is an exclusive, very, very hard to get footage from something that almost no outsider has ever seen. Watch this.
So I'll just pause it here and share with you. This is part of my report that I shared on the Rachel Maddow show. I carried material back with me from overseas to our New York headquarters. And what we've been able to do over the course of several weeks of reporting was gather footage from trusted sources on the ground to help get immediate video after one of these drone strikes into our hands and then broadcast it on US media. And I, at the time, this was absolutely revolutionary because most people had never seen this kind of video before. And just to give you a sense of how difficult this was, I had spent weeks developing sources on the ground until we found someone we knew we could trust in the area. I spent more weeks trying to arm this person with a small handheld camera that was both easy to use but also discreet and wouldn't get him in trouble. And then we spent time just waiting for this person to be in a position where they could see one of these drone strikes happen, be there in the immediate aftermath, gather footage for us, and then safely get that footage back to me. And just getting the footage back to me took another week. We had to move it from courier to courier and town to town until the camera could make its way back to me and I could file this report. Here now is just a little bit of that report that I filed.
This is what many Pakistanis call evidence of an American war with their country. Rare images from the remote tribal region of North Waziristan showing destruction after a U.S. drone strike. The attack occurred at 3 a.m. on March 30th in this market area. One missile pierced the ceiling. More demolished five nearby shops. Four alleged militants were killed in this strike. Their identities were never publicly confirmed. Here in the border region with Afghanistan, strikes like this are not uncommon. But the area hardest hit by the drones is also the most difficult for outsiders to visit or report from.
The collateral damage is way more than what it is even perceived by the people who are doing it.
Pakistani lawyer Shahzad Akbar says he's discovered that while the U.S. drone campaign may yield a few high-value hits, far more civilians are being killed than are reported. Over 300 strikes have been carried out in Pakistan since 2004, but there's enormous controversy surrounding the casualty tally. According to Washington and London-based research groups tracking reports of drone strikes here, as many as 3,000 people have been killed as a result, most of whom are labeled militants under a broad U.S. definition, only a few dozen of which have been identified as militant leaders.
The problem is that no one cares if nobody is killed. And by nobody, I mean a person who is a nobody, a person who is probably just living in that area, has no money, no education, no representation.
So Akbar launched his own campaign, a legal one, to represent local families who suffered civilian casualties in the strikes. He's now filed lawsuits in Pakistani courts suing former U.S. intelligence officials for carrying out the drone program and the government of Pakistan for failing to stop them.
It's incredibly difficult to get any kind of physical evidence from the remote parts of the country where these drone strikes typically occur. But these, what are believed to be fragments of actual Hellfire missiles, were smuggled into Islamabad from those tribal areas.
What I felt this reporting allowed me to do was to open a window to our audience, not just about the impact of the wars we've been fighting overseas, but about what that meant for communities on the ground. And again, not to tell them what to think about this, but just to ask them to want to think about this in the first place. This kind of reporting led to the opportunity I mentioned earlier in 2013, becoming the first Western journalist granted access to North Waziristan, which was then the global hub for Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the area. And I embedded with the Pakistan military. I was able to speak with their commanders on the ground. They were hunkered down in their own sort of frontline bases where even they were fighting for control every day. You know, even as I spoke and interviewed some of the commanders, you kept hearing these booms in the background because they were sending out suppressive mortar rounds into the hills surrounding the base because they were not about to lose an American journalist on their watch. But more importantly, I got to speak with the people on the ground in these communities. And these were parents who wanted roads to link their communities to each other. They wanted schools for their daughters. There were children who were so distressed by the sound of the drones buzzing overhead that their sleep and their days and their health was being interrupted and harmed. And everyone I knew, everyone I talked to there, knew someone or had heard of someone who'd been impacted by one of these strikes, and they knew that it was the U.S. that was sending them. So that led to my reporting on what we saw as the growing anger in the region towards America and how that fueled the political rise of a man who would later go on to run the country, I'm sure a man you've all heard of, named Imran Khan. Here now is a short clip of some of that work.
Frustrations here are running high. Pakistanis increasingly displeased with the status quo, disillusioned with their own government, and disgusted by U.S. influence and actions in their country. This protest in Islamabad, the nation's capital, is just one of a series of opposition rallies across the country this week, drawing tens of thousands into the streets, hoping to capitalize on the anti-U.S. and anti-government fervor growing in Pakistan and jockey for political position well in advance of the elections in 2013.
Hundreds of people have gathered in the streets to join a rally led by Imran Khan to protest the drone strikes by America. This in a week when already two strikes occurred just yesterday.
Now, Imran Khan rode that anti-American sentiment into power, and I saw in real time how U.S. foreign policy, directly or indirectly, could have huge implications on the ground. Of course, it wasn't all terrorism and national security, because no country is, right? I reported on culture and arts, on music and everyday life, and when a young activist that I had come to know was targeted by the Taliban and shot, I got to introduce more of the world to Malala Yousafzai. And I'll share this with you, though everyone knows her now. Back then, I actually had to advocate for us to do this story in the first place because not many people knew who she was. And on the very first night when the story broke, I believe I was at NBC at the time, were the only national US network broadcast to report on her attack. Here is part, just a short clip of that report.
And from Pakistan tonight, a truly shocking story of brutality against a 14-year-old girl targeted for assassination by the Taliban because she dared to stand up and speak out. The world is just now learning about this and reacting to it in horror. We get our report tonight from our NBC News Pakistan-based correspondent Amna Nawaz.
She is known as a fighter for peace, for the right of girls like her to go to school. That made 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai an enemy of the Taliban. Today, gunmen hunted her down at her school in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Police say her classmates tried to protect her. But the men waited until Malala came out, and they shot her, once in the neck, once in the head. A Taliban spokesman claimed responsibility for the attack, saying they'd wanted to kill her for at least a year, to silence a voice that dared to speak out against them.
They cannot stop me. I will get my education if it is in home, school, or any place.
One last clip I'll share from my time overseas. You know, I was also able to cover the U.S. raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. And a year later, when I learned it would be demolished, I raced back to Abbottabad to see what else they had learned and how about how he'd come to stay in Pakistan for all those years, undetected by most. Here's just a short clip from that report.
With the death of Osama bin Laden 1 year later, NBC's Pakistan bureau chief, Amna Nawaz, is in Abbottabad this morning. Amna, good morning to you.
Good morning, Matt. Pakistan Today is still working to get past this embarrassing episode and to answer the tough questions about how the terror chief stayed hidden here for so long.
Today, this is all that's left of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad. Scrap, thousands of bricks, even his bathtubs. A collection culled from his compound before it was demolished.
It's mostly broken, but I will donate some to the poor and sell the rest at an auction.
Pakistani authorities leveled the place in February, reducing it to a field of rubble and concrete slabs. Today, it still attracts a lot of attention as the preferred cricket ground for local children. And those widows, children, and grandchildren left behind in the compound, some of whom are seen here. They were kept secluded by Pakistani authorities under heavy guard for almost a year, then quickly shuttled out last week in the dead of night, deported to Saudi Arabia after a Pakistani court convicted them for staying here illegally.
Now, the rest of this story, which I'll share, is that after tracking down the contractor who'd been hired to carry out the demolition, I learned that he did donate some of the materials, but he reserved a lot of the materials for reuse and resale. And he agreed to sell me two of the bricks for a few rupees each from the bin Laden compound, which I wrapped up in shawls and packed deep into my luggage and brought home with me. And one now sits in my home office and the other sits in my father's. I had a few questions to answer from airport security on the way out. But that one little brick, I will say, is one of my reminders that you have to go to the story. You have to be in the middle of it to better understand it. Now, my years overseas solidified some of those lessons in the reporting process. You have to work really hard to avoid groupthink. You have to get out of your bubble, and you have to be mindful of the assumptions that you're working with. Also, that as good as your official sources are, the real stories that we have to work to never lose sight of are those of the people who are actually impacted by the decisions of the powerful. Those are the people that we serve. Those are the voices we should seek to amplify. And so as my career advanced, even as I found myself in an anchor chair at first at ABC News, I was anchoring most of our streaming coverage of the 2016 presidential election, I really fought hard to get out into the field and continue reporting. As part of that work, I was able to do a documentary at ABC, which is reporting for one full year from a very small Texas panhandle town that had the highest level of support for Donald Trump in 2016. There were four families there that I got to know who eventually agreed to allow me into their lives. And what was remarkable to me all those years later, after I rebased back to the States after being overseas, was how many full circle moments I would have reporting back here in the States. So many of the stories that had defined the early part of my career were also defining moments for people that I spoke to many, many years later, and they would bring these things up again and again. This is just one example of that in a way I never could have anticipated. This is a short clip from one of the people I got to know doing this documentary in Texas. The town there is called Miami. It's in Roberts County. And this is a man named Steve Porter. He voted for President Trump. And in this moment, we were talking about some of the things that then-candidate Trump had said during the campaign, in particular about why Mr. Porter supported him.
He is a strong leader, and he is putting forth a forceful image of our country.
But he's not a fan of everything the president does.
I disagree with him doing those tweets without asking some of his smart people. I tell you what, if I had a brilliant daughter and son-in-law like he has, before I'd tweet, I'd ask them.
He ran on this idea of banning people from entering the country if they were Muslim. Mm-hmm. Did you agree with that?
It's not the most popular religion with me, because what it's done is it's put its women down to a third rate.
You know that's not the religion as a whole, right? I mean, there are millions of Muslims right here in America who don't practice it that way.
Sure. My first roommate in college was full-blown Islamic. Mm-hmm. And his name was Fawaz, we called him Fuzz. And every once in a while, you know, he'd throw out his little magic carpet there between our beds. And
his prayer rug?
Well, I called it his magic carpet, you know. I loved Fuzz. He told me all about his world of Saudi Arabia. And when I saw those planes, when I saw those planes fly into those buildings, and they said that they were Muslims, and I thought, that can't be people that are Fuzz's people.
I will tell you, I'm still in touch with Mr. Porter and his family today, and he's a lovely man. Now, I have to say, too, very few anchors in the United States have this experience as foreign correspondents. Many of them have dropped in and out of stories overseas, but not over a sustained period of time. And that has always surprised me, because I found the experience of serving overseas to be enormously helpful in informing my work back in the U.S. When I interview officials now about their stance on foreign policy or national security or immigration, I'm able to pull from my firsthand experience on the ground, and not just to ask the right question or some version of it, but to follow up again and again and again. When I co-moderated the 2019 presidential debate, my question to then candidate Biden was about US officials knew privately versus what they were messaging publicly about the war in Afghanistan. And that was based on my being there, you know, my seeing the effects of a shifting strategy on the ground, talking to Afghans who were there, people growing increasingly frustrated with the US presence, embedding with US soldiers who felt they were losing their sense of mission. I will say that time overseas has also helped me better spot some trends back here in the US as they've emerged. I covered stories in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Syria and Turkey and beyond, but I also, over my life, I've lived and traveled in Zimbabwe and India and parts of South and Central America, and I have seen in real time how democracies, young and old, can be tested by forces on the ground, how the press can be manipulated or brought under government influence, how foundational tenets of a democratic system can be bent and bent and bent until in some cases they break, and how forces that were once dismissed as fringe can move closer to the center and can be more dangerous as a result. I was always deeply concerned and deeply curious about what I saw as the rise of white nationalism and white supremacist groups over the years leading up to, and certainly through the election of Mr. Trump, and I had seen our entire government pour resources into a new government agency, the Department of Homeland Security, after 9/11, in response to an external threat at the very beginning of my career. I saw an entire government reshaped to meet and respond to that threat. I also saw how slow some of those same authorities were to recognize the rise of this new domestic homegrown threat, one that I decided in my work to confront head on. So my years overseas taught me one thing, that you have to be very comfortable being uncomfortable. And at ABC, I launched a show called That. It was called Uncomfortable. It was a podcast. It was hour-long, extended one-on-one conversations with thought leaders about some of the most difficult topics of our day. And in one episode, I sat down for an hour with a man who's widely known as sort of the grandfather of modern white nationalism in America. He's a man named Jared Taylor, and he shared his views on why he believes that people of different races shouldn't mix in America. And I pushed him on why he had publicly and vocally supported the presidency of Donald Trump, what precisely his vision was for this nation, and who it could harm. This is just a brief clip from our conversation. You know I'm Muslim. You know I'm first-generation American. What is it like for you to say these things to someone who you know does not share the same views and could even take a lot of these things personally?
The fact that you are a first-generation non-white American, an immigrant, you are part of the dispossession of my people, because you happen to be such a person, isn't going to make me change my views at all. Why would it?
You're welcome to go online and watch the full conversation. I won't play more of that here. I will say I have arrived today, more than 20 years into my career as a journalist, at a point where I am so grateful for these conversations, for the years I've spent reporting from places that most people will never, ever set foot. And I really wish, for the life of me, I wish we could require all political journalists to spend consistent and sustained time reporting on the ground from communities away from the center of power. I know what that time did for me in terms of broadening but also sharpening my lens at the same time. The culmination of all of these experiences, of course, was never more clear than on January 6th of 2021. I stood outside the Capitol, was reporting from among the mobs that had, in many cases, people had flown in from across the country or driven several hours just to be there because they believed in the lie of a stolen 2020 election. And the same mistrust that I'd seen among disenchanted and disconnected people in other countries around the world, that same mistrust I saw on those grounds here, it was unfolding in my own country. The same willingness to embrace conspiracy theories that I had seen take hold in nations where people no longer felt the system served them, that was happening here. The same willingness to embrace violence as a means towards a political end, because some political force had leveraged those feelings of disconnection and grievance, that's the same feeling I saw play out in countries around the world, and it was playing out in the only country I'd ever called home. So I stood outside during our live rolling coverage for several hours straight of the insurrection that day, and I made those connections in real-time reporting for our audience that I had seen these scenes before, many times in other nations, but I never thought I would see them here. I think what it showed us on that day was that America is not immune. Now, every now and again, a story comes along where all the lessons that I've tried to retain from along the way come into alignment, and I want to share a brief clip from one of those stories now. You may or may not have heard of a man named Mark Frerichs. He's an American military veteran. He was working as a contractor in Afghanistan for many years. He was part of the rebuilding effort that I had spent so long reporting on while I was there. And I knew a lot of guys like Mark over the years. They were incredibly smart, incredibly adventurous. They wanted to be part of a mission and something bigger than themselves. And I also knew that every time I set foot in those countries where Americans weren't necessarily always welcome, I was putting myself at risk. But I always believed my government would come get me if needed. And in Mark's case, that did not happen right away. He was kidnapped and he was held hostage by Taliban-aligned forces for over 2.5 years. He was held in unimaginable circumstances. He was tortured, he faced mock executions, he had to record and send back hostage videos pleading for his government, for his president to help him. He was believed to be held in a part of the world that very few Western journalists had ever been, except for me. And I covered Mark's detention as someone who knew very well the forces that were holding him, who could imagine the circumstances and the conditions and the environment in which he was being held, and who could see, to some degree, my family in his as they waited and they worried and they wondered when they would ever see him again, especially as US forces packed up and left the country and left Mark behind. Now, Mark was finally released after a series of long negotiations and a lot of hard work by a lot of people. And I knew when he came back, he would only give one interview, because those conversations can be intense and traumatic, and you cannot reasonably ask anyone to do that over and over. So I was honored when Mark said that he would talk to me. He knew that I had been where he was. He knew I had seen what he'd seen. And after years of brutal treatment and torture, and quite frankly, a fortitude of spirit and hope that I can only dream to one day have, he was able to share a little bit of his experience with us.
Mark's hometown welcomed him back with open arms. He's reconnected with childhood friends.
It's been a long time, man.
Gone out to restaurants. And is back to practicing his magic skills.
Oh, very nice.
But he has a long way to go.
You've only been back just over 3 months, yeah. Right? How are you doing?
Doing good. Main thing is keeping it up physically. I seem to be doing okay. I'm in a relationship, so that's working out good. A lot of support for people knowing what I've been through. And yeah, I'm having intermittent sleep issues. Sometimes I'll just have these feelings come across me of like impending danger, you know, but they pass.
Yeah.
He is starting over in every way. No job, no home, hoping a GoFundMe will help sustain him. His savings and equipment were looted back in Afghanistan. After 32 months in captivity, he doesn't know what's next. But what he does know is he is free.
Mark, your day-to-day life now, though, means you can move around freely.
Yeah.
You can open the door and walk outside. You can look up and see the blue sky above you. It is a world away from your life over the last 2.5 years.
Yeah.
They took 2.5 years of your life from you.
Right.
There's no anger there?
If I harbor resentment or carry on continual feeling of anger, then they've won. Resentment for the past is a waste of spirit. If I don't let this thing go, it's going to just keep festering and festering. I got to just let it out, let it go.
He's a remarkable man. You know, I am privileged these days to sit in one of the most trusted anchor chairs in the country. I know the duty and responsibility that comes with that, especially at this moment in American history. And I know that your focus here, where so many of you are interested, is on the broader world around us, foreign policy, how we can better understand events around the world and our place in it. But I really hope that I've been able to share how all of my years covering many of those events and watching and listening and asking questions on the front lines has informed and continues to influence the work that I do today. It's work that demands discomfort and curiosity and a willingness to see and learn from the common threads that tie all of these stories together. And I'll tell you honestly, it is work that I truly love and feel honored to do. I still believe that by better understanding the world around us, we will better understand ourselves. I want to thank all of you so much for having me here today, and I really look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Amna, thank you very, very much. Really appreciate your coming to speak with us today. I usually take the opportunity while they're collecting questions from the audience to ask one of my own. So I get things started with an easy question. What do you think the effect is of today's political turmoil in the U.S. on the view of the world, the world's view of the U.S.? Are we really hurting ourselves by what we're doing now domestically?
I think it's very clear and very true to say that the world is watching. It's true. I mean, this is not just from conversations with officials from other nations, but with national security officials here in America. We know that not just our allies, but also our adversaries watch very carefully our own political discussions, our elections, any internal turmoil and turbulence and uncertainty. They also know the political winds here shift very quickly, and you can see this, especially in recent history, how a lot of other nations have been hedging bets to some degree to see which way those winds will blow. They don't know if a policy in place today will stand longer than 4 years until the next presidential election, and many of them will say that in conversations behind closed doors. So, absolutely, I mean, I think one of the things we've seen over the last few years that we can all agree, and that the Western alliance, I think, NATO-led alliance would agree is a good thing, is the coming together in response to Russia's attack on Ukraine. It was sort of a reestablishment of many of those Western democracy norms, that there is still a strong enough alliance to respond to that kind of threat. But you look at a number of other nations, I think, India, for example, China, certainly, and you see how there are a lot of decisions being made at the highest levels that don't necessarily align with one administration or another, and people there are very closely watching. I will say the one thing I read recently in going back and looking at some of our coverage of January 6th was how those events not only played out on all of our front pages and the headlines of our news, but all across Chinese TV and all across Russian TV, and all across Indian and Peruvian, and so just everyone was watching. And I think there are people are asking a lot of questions about the stability of American democracy in the same way that we are here.
Thank you. I can already see we have quite a few questions really asking you to reflect on the state of journalism in the U.S. today and all of the financial pressures that journalism is under, as well as the, you know, just the general attitude of a lot of American citizens that they can't trust the press.
Yeah, I get asked a lot about trust in the media because, like any other institution, media has seen a decline in American trust in recent years. That's true of Congress and the CDC and the Supreme Court now. Media is not different from any of this. I think that's part of a larger discontent within the American public just about systems of power and accountability right now, when media is certainly part of that. If anything, I think it's incumbent on us as journalists to work to win that trust back. That's our job. That's what we are here to do, and that's not something that happens overnight. But I'll also say, when you have individual conversations with people about why they don't trust the media and also how you define the media, you'll find that there's a lot more nuance to that conversation. I'm sure if I sat down with 10 of you right now, we'd have 10 different ideas about who you'd consider to be the media. Now, I have the benefit of working in public media, which is separate and apart in many ways from the commercial institutions in which I used to work. Some of the pressures are not the same. Certainly, I think we're much more mission-driven than I've seen in other places I've worked. But we are also not immune to many of the same pressures that all other journalists and journalism outlets face. I mean, local newsrooms across the country have been shuttering at an alarming rate. And that is so bad for those communities, for the states, for our country, for our democracy. So we think about a lot of this on a national level, and I know we say a lot of our politics have been nationalized, sometimes our news becomes nationalized. I would encourage all of you as much as you can to refocus a lot of attention on local news and local outlets, because honestly, I think that is one of the central parts of our system that's not getting the funding or attention it deserves.
So just to follow up a little bit on this, what do you think is the greatest threat to American journalism today? Social media, foreign interference, education problems, et cetera. Where can we ask the easy questions here?
Sure, yeah, just real quick. What's the biggest threat? I don't know that there is one. The single biggest, newest threat, I think, is certainly misinformation and active disinformation campaigns. The news landscape, the information landscape, is more noisy and crowded and messy than it's ever been at any point in my career, and I think in American history. And I think in many ways it's taken journalists a little bit longer to realize that there's a war. There is an information war going on, and whether or not we like it, we're a part of it. It's no longer good enough to just sit back and continue or do our jobs as usual. We have to call out the bad information in addition to putting out the good information. Now, I'm a firm believer in the idea that the good stuff rises to the top. I still think we just have to continue to do more good journalism, that the answer to all this bad information is more good information in its place. But that's certainly, it's a new trend, it's a very worrying trend. And it's something journalists aren't alone in worrying about, I think.
Does it discourage you that so many Americans accept false stories and conspiracy theories?
I don't know if discourage is the word. It no longer surprises me. I've been in enough communities and engaged with enough people who have some of these beliefs to know that if you ask people who believe in things that just provably aren't true, they feel they are very well informed. This is not an opinion or an idea they've arrived at lightly. They feel like they have reports and information and sources, and they feel very strongly about this information. I'm not discouraged by it because I have found in those one-on-one conversations, I believe people are reasonable. And honestly, when you engage with them and put facts in front of them, they may not always change their minds, but they are willing to engage. The problem for me, I think the larger problem for our country, is the scale at which this is happening. And the number of people who are in positions of power, who have enormous platforms, who are willing and really quite interested and incentivized by continuing to spread that misinformation. When you talk to people about one of the many ways in which we want to be able to push back against disinformation campaigns, a central part of that has to be people who have these big platforms actively pushing back against it. Right now, we have one political party that leveraged a lot of those election lies into political power and then backed away from some of them. And when you have a two-party system and one party is incentivized by the spread of bad information, that's bad for our system. So we have a lot of systemic issues, I think, that contribute to that. But I'm not discouraged. I fight on every day.
So someone wants to know where you get your news. Do you listen to other news outlets?
I do. I have a wide range of news interests, and I actually, against my own business interests, encourage people to read and take in a lot of different news sources. I think that's how you have a healthy news diet. So just in the way of insight, in my office I have multiple screens up, and I toggle all day between MSNBC and Fox and CNN and CNBC and BBC, and I just kind of keep different news channels up just to get a sense of how people are covering different stories and what their priorities are. We, in the morning, you know, in our home, we're actually still kind of dinosaurs. We get printed newspapers, which is shocking to many Americans, I know. Thank you. I like holding a physical newspaper. We enjoy reading it. We like our daughters to see that there's a bigger world out there outside of our kitchen, and so we continue to get that. I listen to podcasts. I've got NPR on in the background. I take in as much as I can, and even then, you always feel like you're missing something.
So in a related question, because a lot of people don't read multiple news sources, how do you get your message across to people who watch only one new network? Or how do you get them to actually increase or expand their sources of information?
So if you only have time for one news outlet in your life, obviously, that's going to be the PBS NewsHour. And then, from there, you can supplement. No, I think the other thing I think journalists have to remember, too, is that no one else takes in the amount of information and the detail that we do every day that most people don't have time for it. How on earth could you? And so, really, truly, one of the things that I really do take pride in what we do at NewsHour is not just tell you what happened, but why it matters, why you should care about it. And it's one of the reasons I'm just so proud to be a member of the team and proud of the work that we do every day. But I also tell people, you don't have to watch the news every day. You don't. I think people can scan a headline here or there, read stories they're interested in. If you watch and take in a few reliable, credible news sources a few times a week, you can be a generally informed member of society. And I think that is sort of the bar. When I talk to young students and college students in particular who can feel really easily overwhelmed by the amount of information that's flowing every day, that's what I tell them. That's an easy entry level. And I think it's a healthy way to kind of take information in day to day.
I'm a person who likes the newspaper in front of me too, to scan the headlines, read a few paragraphs and find out whether you want to read more, but beyond the obvious, what are the differences you see between print journalism and journalism practice in the non-print media? Is it absorbed differently? Is it?
I suppose that depends on the consumer. I find a reason to engage in all kinds of media. I read print stories, I listen to podcasts, I watch documentaries, I watch short-form stories online. I think every form of media has its own power and potency. And there are some things that you can do in print that you just can't do in any other medium. And there are some things you can do in video that you just can't do in any other medium. I think the best journalism, regardless of how it's told, is something that leaves you feeling like you learned something and that you walk away better informed about it and caring about it for some reason. And I'm really platform agnostic. You know, I've done podcasts, I've done documentaries, I do daily news, breaking news. I think there are lots of different ways to get your message across. And again, going back to what's incumbent upon us as journalists, we have to show up where people are. So if you only want to listen to the radio, we have to make sure our news is there. If you only want to sit back and watch an hour documentary once a week, we have to make sure our news is there. That's our job.
Here's someone who wants to know about the effect of AI and what it's going to do to your industry.
Well, people keep telling me it's going to put me out of a job. I'm waiting. I will say I've experimented. I'm not sure how many folks out there have ever experimented with any one of these platforms. I've experimented with a few of them just to see how good they're getting. I've asked a couple in particular, you know, put together a research pack for me on XYZ, or if you were interviewing this specific person, what are 5 questions you would ask this person? And what I got back was garbage. It was not something I would use. And so that made me feel a little better about my job. But, you know, I'll tell you, in conversations with national security experts in particular, and this is something actually that was said on the record, I had a conversation with the Secretary of Homeland Security, who covers so many different topics in his job day to day. And when I asked what keeps him up at night, he said AI. And he has launched a new task force. He's put new resources, new staffing behind it, specifically to look at the threats of artificial intelligence, because he believes, and has said this publicly as well, that we are so far behind our level of understanding and that there are very real national security threats there we need to unpack.
So now there are a couple of questions here about specific countries and what your views are of what's happening there. Someone says, my dear friends in Istanbul are in despair over Erdogan's re-election. Do you think it's going to get better or worse? Or
I think economies can be a good indicator sometimes. If the economy is any indicator in Turkey, it's going to get worse before it gets better. I haven't seen where the lira is right now, but last I checked, it was dropping fast. One of the things we've seen with Erdogan, who's someone, by the way, I've interviewed in person, I know how he operates, this consolidation of power around his office has been slow and steady and really powerful and effective over the years. And I think a lot of folks thought after this previous devastating earthquake they just lived for that that foundation had been shaken and it might shake loose some of that support. But he and his party have done such an incredible job of tamping down on the media, on silencing the opposition, that even whatever small base of support had popped up for the opposition at the moment was quickly tamped down, and he won again. So at this stage, it's an area I'm deeply interested in. I hope to go back to at some point, but I think it's fair to say he's not going anywhere for a number of years, and it will probably get worse before it gets better.
And a couple, I think, that are more a personal note. For you, I'm assuming you still have some relatives in Pakistan, and someone wants to know how concerned you are that Pakistan could become a failed state, and what can the U.S. do to help mitigate that risk?
I think if the definition of a failed state is one in which there's no longer a functioning democracy, it's pretty close to that already. I mean, anyone who understands Pakistan, as I'm sure you all do, knows for its entire independent history, it has just swung between brief civilian governments and military dictatorships, and the military largely calls the shots behind the scenes, even throughout the civilian governments. What you have now is another civilian government in which the military is calling the shots, and a huge crackdown on the opposition there. And thousands of supporters, civilians, supporters of the opposition government have been rounded up and thrown into jail as well. So it's worrying for a number of reasons, worrying from a democratic standpoint, I think from a human rights standpoint. It's interesting to see where this falls on the list of US priorities. And you will hear this, whatever US official you talk to right now, the war in Ukraine has taken up so much oxygen in the room and so many slots on the priority list that I know a number of US officials who are equally frustrated by the lack of a more vocal US response to this. Members of Congress have also sent letters to the White House and other places asking for more involvement, but it's just not a very high priority right now.
And finally, again, on a personal note, you've obviously covered very many tragic situations. How do you personally handle news stories where there's a lot of tragedy involved and keep yourself from getting emotionally involved in the situation?
I married very well. I have a very good therapist. I enjoy gin. All of these things can be true. In all seriousness, I talk a lot about this, in particular with younger journalists, because when I was coming up, you saw a lot of horrible things. You witness the worst of humanity, and then they say, good job, okay, off on to the next one, and you're just expected to be okay and move on. And there was also a sort of a gallows humor and a bit of cynicism around everything, which I look back now and see was just a coping mechanism for so many of my bosses. I don't think I could do that. I know I can't do that. I refuse to be cynical about the state of the world, and I refuse to be fatalistic about our future. And so I care, and I show up, and I care. And I think that there are ways to do this job that can still be effective journalism, be powerful ways in which people in positions of power are held to account, in which the stories of people are upheld and amplified, and you can still care and find a place to put it and move on to the next story. And when I tell young journalists today that this is how I hope they do the work, I really encourage them to take care of themselves along the way. Because this is not the kind of job, as I said before, that you can do at a safe distance. You have to show up with your full self, but you have to treat it like a marathon and not a sprint. So that's how I'd answer that.
So thank you very much. Really appreciate this.
Thank you.